accession number 28898, reel 6.
West Charles with reel 6. Could you tell me something about the attitude that you had towards the Germans and how they behaved?
Well, you didn't. I never thought of them as being enemy or Germans. People, they were just aircraft. I didn't think of the people sitting inside them at all. Because you never saw them, really. I mean, if they flashed past very close, you just saw a helmet looking at you, but you didn't see them. So, the Royal Air Force, the British Royal Air Force, you know, the people who were Canadians and the Americans or whatever, Canadians and the Australians and the British Empire, Caucasian sort of people, I think we behaved quite correctly, really did. But I can understand the Poles, because every German, as far as they were concerned, was going to be a dead German, whether they were civilians, children, or what they were, because Poland was being raped, and they just wanted to get Germans killed. And so they got a bit undisciplined. We could understand it. We knew what they were feeling. You see, they'd escaped, most of them, the Polish pilots in the Polish Air Force, which was decimated by the Luftwaffe, and they escaped. They came to England, so they had some flying experience. And the first Polish fighter squadron was 303, and all their aces and the top people were in that, and it was a fantastic operation, really, tremendously well, but ill-disciplined. Right, the Germans are going to get out. No, shut up, we've got to get out. and the German pilots too, on the whole, were pretty good, pretty decent. As I think I mentioned, this chap, a friend of mine who was shot down in the squadron, who got ashore in Holland, I think I put someone in there, and was picked up by he did all the right things. He bailed out. It was an evening sweep coming back. He was shot down. Pete Dunford, I think his name was. And got into his dinghy. It was, by this time it was getting dark, and he was somewhere in the North Sea. It was a very black night. And he didn't know where he was, but he suddenly felt his dinghy was hitting something. He put his hand out, and there was sand. He thought, Christ, which way out? Where are we? So he got his compass out and said, well, it must be Holland. And so anyway, he climbed out of his dinghy. There was a lot of large expanse of sand, which he went up on his hands, and he thought, this might be mine. And in fact, after the war we worked out, he'd gone right through a German minefield and hadn't hit a mine. On his hands and knees, it was a very heavily fortified area. He got eventually across the sand to the sort of ditch sandy area. Yeah, sandbank sort of area, and he climbed through this, dropped into a ditch, and listened carefully, and he could actually hear the Germans motoring about and talking as they went by. And well, he was a bit silly. He got further into Holland, and eventually got into Holland, deep into Holland, well, as far as he could get into Holland, and he holed up in the thicket, really thick, got inside there, and put sort of kind of twigs around him and got in there. And there was a house down below, and it was a house on its own, quite a substantial house, and did exactly what we were briefed to do. He kept watch on it for a couple of days to see who went in and out of it, and he saw this fellow going to work every morning with his attaché case and looking smart and well-dressed, and he saw one or two kids going in, and occasionally the housewife, and so I thought, well, they look like decent sort of Dutch people. So one day, as it was getting dark, he dashed down there and said, knocked on the door, said, I'm a British pilot, been shot down here, and can you help me? And his wife answered the door, but she said, come inside quickly. So he came inside and closed the door. She could speak a bit of English actually. And she said, right, now, go into the room, said, oh, I'll see you. She went in, and he realised immediately that they would be on his side, you know. And They kept him in a room in the attic and fed him and everything. Now, then they were working out who was to contact. There was a chain of people that used to get part of it. So how to stream all, like ants all the way, going from France, across over the Pyrenees, to the embassy there, back to England, and back to the squadron again. And this concert, the French and Belgian, we had this worked out very well, and the Dutch, very resistant, so very, very good, helping people to get back. And they said, right, we'll get in touch with the people who will help you get home. And now, so they said, really, don't move out of this attic until that happens. Just don't move. Don't go to the window. Don't look out of the window. Just don't be seen. Just stay there. Keep down. And he was there for a while. I don't know how many days, but a few days. But there were three sons in this family, and the eldest son had been persuaded by some Germans he knew, who was occupied, of course, at the time, that they should join the German-Dutch Bund, they called it. It was where young Dutch kids became sort of part of the German army, really. Like senior boy scouts, but they had words sort of German senior and everything. And he gave him away. He went to a German and said, oh, we're harbouring a British fighter pilot. And so one day to the door came these Luftwaffe airmen, Luftwaffe, those military policemen, Luftwaffe. And they said, ah, sir, we must take you away. Lord knows what happened to that family. But anyway, he was taken to an airfield called Ursel, which eventually we used to fly from when we went into France. Strange. And it was a Focke Wulf 190 base. He was taken in to see the station commander, and he was a bit worried about everything, you know, and the station commander said, ah, sir, salute him, back. He said, kept calling him sir, and he could speak quite good English. And he said, unfortunately, I can only keep you on this base for 2 weeks, then I have to hand you over to the German police, the German army police, or the interrogators or whatever. So he said, now I must have your word before I let you go to the mess, that you will not try to escape whilst you are here. Can I have your word on that? Well, Pete Durnford quite correctly said, no, sir, you can't. I shall try and escape at every possible opportunity. That's my duty to get back. Well, I quite understand that. In that case, I'm afraid we'll have to keep you in the mess until we have to hand you over. Mm-hmm. But I'll keep you here for 2 weeks. You're part of the mess, just to go and drink at the bar, have dinner, dining in nights with them. And they all went around asking him about the boy, England, or exchange addresses, we'll come and visit you. And, and he was introduced to the chap who shot him down. The station master said, we think we worked out who shot you down, Mr. Dunford. Is this Lieutenant Sergeant? And he's terrified little Lieutenant Luftwaffe pilot he shook hands with. And said, I'm very sorry, sir, that I had to shoot you down, but, you know, it happens to anybody. And anyway, it was quite a camaraderie. And he said, before they went, before he had to be given over to the I don't know what they were, I suppose, it was the German army, I suppose, the people who interrogated them, took them to prisoners of war camps. He said, have you got one last wish before you leave? He said, now, I've got your address in England, and I'll keep in touch. And you come and see me when, after the war, you come and see me in Germany, and we have a good time together. And so he then said, Peter, is there anything you'd like to ask me before or see before you leave me, before I give you? He said, yes. He said, I don't know whether this is possible, but I'd love to go and see a 190. He said, we've seen him in the air, we've shot some down, you shot some down, but they looked on and forever. Could I see one? Station commander sort of thought a bit, yes, you could echo after, but he thought, well, he's going to a prison walk up anyway. So he said, yes, you may. Well, I will take you down to see one. So he took him down and showed him all around a 190. And then, of course, he had to be handed over, which was a very different kettle of fish, because he had a bit of a hard time through questioning and all the rest of it. But he escaped from the prisoner of war camp he was in. And he came back. And he came back to the squadron, brought in, said, what have you been? What do you mean? He said, oh, God, he said, I've had a bit of a time. I'll tell you something. When over a beer, I'll tell you about it sometime. But he said, but that was the Dutch for you. They're great. That's how they treat it. You know, and even now, I get every year an invitation to go across to a cemetery where my number two, we were dive bombing at the time, was shot down. And these Dutch people, they went to the grave, they saw the Spitfire plunge into the ground, and they went to it, and they, much against the German rules, they got Pete Maltby's body out of the aircraft, and they gave it a civilian burial in their cemetery in this little town. I can't remember the name now. What's the town in Holland, Jeannie, where we go to? Jeannie?
Yes, darling.
What is the town in Holland where we go to and go to these ceremonies?
No, I guess.
Oh, I can't think of it. Sorry, North Holland, anyway. And they have, they actually have a shop window in the middle of the market square. It's only a small town. With Pete of Durnford's picture on it. And, Pete Maltby's picture, whom they just buried. And all the paraphernalia, his uniform and jackets and everything, it's there in the window. And they started up a 185 squad. I was on then, a 185 historical collection. And every year they invite us across, or I used to go across. And it was a fantastic time. All the town used to turn out, we were paraded down the streets. It was incredible. I can't go now because of my legs. But they still send Christmas cards. And write and say, oh, Freddie Bauhaus, he's still doing well, he still runs his pub here in Holland, and Jimmy so-and-so, he's still doing, you know, they tell us information about other people that they've been in contact with in the squadron that I've just lost contact with. And people come all the way from Australia to go to this thing. From Australia, Max Wilson, Australian pilot, who's now dead, but his wife's still alive, and she comes across with her daughter. And, oh, and they give us a fantastic... We're treated as though we've just liberated the place. And I keep thinking to myself, it's 60 years ago now. What the hell do they keep doing this for? But they keep doing it. Every year they try to get us across there.
How did your time in 602 Squadron come to end? What kind of length of tour did you do in 41?
I joined mid-41 sometime. I can't remember the exact time now. And it was... about a year, I suppose. About a year. And then this secret emergency service fighter unit thing came up.
What was the background to you volunteering for that?
Well, it was put around. There's a new thing coming up. A secret thing coming up. Flying aircraft from merchant ships. And I put my name down for it, didn't think anything would happen. Okay, so there's some doors or something like it. It really is drafty. It's on the same as it won't be long.
Was it just a notice board?
It came around saying anybody interested in this thing, just put the phone name down here. Well, I must admit, I was getting a little bit... Yeah, I felt... I think I'd like a change from this now. I'm getting a little bit hairy around the edges. So I put my name down for it. I didn't think it would be anything. I thought it was just a rest period, because everybody had a rest period after a certain amount of time flying.
Were you getting a bit? Did you say were you getting a bit tired?
Getting a bit jittery.
Constant strain.
Jittery. Your nerves start to get a bit. You jump, the doors close hard, and you just get your nerves get jittery.
So do you come in that kind of constant, almost in that constant state that you're in when you're flying? Does that almost take over in when you're sitting around?
Well, to a certain extent. I mean, you're always tense, because you never know when you're going to fly. And you live in a sort of tense atmosphere the whole time. And then if in summer, when you're doing sort of three sweeps a day, perhaps, it's a very tiring, nervous period, very little sleep. I was saying midsummer, we'd get up for briefing at perhaps 3 o'clock in the morning and not get into bed until 11 o'clock at night. You really got 4 hours in to try to get a bit of sleep in. And having had a pretty tough day. So you're living with it the whole time, you know, it's going on around you the whole time. And yes, eventually nerves go. A different period, some people stick it out for long nerves. But I wasn't feeling, I didn't leave for that reason. I just thought this sounds interesting. Change.
What kind of information was given on that? Was it literally just that this is a secret thing, or did you know that it was the sort of catapult assisted merchantman type?
They said it involves flying aircraft from merchantmen, hurricanes from merchantmen. That's about all they said. So I thought, well, I'll have a look at it anyway. So I put my name down, and another fellow did, and we were both selected to do it. Well, that's quite a few people put their names down, I think, but we were selected to do it. And, I think it was supposed to be a rest period. It was the most frightening 2 years of my life spent in merchant service fighter unit, because, well, being launched, first of all, it was a real Heath Robinson device. They had a sort of, not a catapult, it was a rail, sort of rails on the forecastle of a merchant ship, on which was a little trolley, which ran out of these rails, and on the trolley was mounted the Hurricane. In the back of the trolley were 13 cordite rockets, fired in another Heath Robinson method by a chap down in a, looking up at you from the forecastle. You'd be down there because you were pretty high up, and he fired you off when you were ready to go. But you only had about, I don't know, 60 feet or something to get airborne, to get from zero knots to 60 knots. It was just a great boom when you were airborne. But you had to put your heels in two little things on the floor of things so your feet wouldn't come back. And you had a bit of right rudder to counteract the torque. You throttle wide open and the wing nut really tight so that you couldn't just come back and the G-force was going off. And you put your head back on a little rest, a sort of sawbow rest, put your head back on. And when everything was okay, and all, you put your hand up, and you pull it down, and with your right hand, or your head on the stick, with your elbow stuck in your stomach, so you wouldn't pull the thing back automatically. And then you put your hand up, and you're ready to fire off, and you took it down, and the chap down in the little sentry box on the forecastle, normally the second mate, who knew nothing about aircraft or what it was like to fly them, clicked the switch which electrically fired all 13 rockets. Now, if he did this when you got 3 seconds, hand down and it was 3 seconds and he'd fire. Now the point is that you only left the end of dead straight and level. You left the end at just over stalling speed. If the ship, and there were only small merchant ships, was going into the sea, and of course you had to go into the sea because you had to take them into the wind, so it was always going like this, down into the surf then back up again. If he fired you off when you're at that angle going down, pointing down, of course you'd thunder straight into the water. Poof. If when you're coming up and he did it too high, you wouldn't have flying speed at the end, and you'd still so ideally he had to fire you off when you were coming up from a swell, so you're about level when he fired you off. But you sit there, sometimes he wouldn't get it right, because he'd be as nervous as a kitten. He'd think, well, Christ, what am I doing? I'm probably going to kill this guy. And so he's looking out, and sometimes you pull your hand out. And of course, these were reconditioned hurricanes fish out of the sea that had been shot down. They were one flight, they were going to do one mission, and they were going to had a bail out and they went into the water, they lost. So they weren't the latest designs or very well kept aircraft. But the engines were all too, and the engines were given special boost. The Merlin 1 engine would get boosted up to about 16 pounds. So you always had a glycol leak every time you flew one. Open the throttle and white puffs of glycol would come out and you're saying, for Christ's sake, it's strenuous screaming and way over its limits. And of course, when you pull your hand down, you're waiting for the shock of the shoot off. Well, you're going down like this, and you think, no, not now. And he was always, it should have been 3 seconds, you see. And eventually you get it right, and you put it on. And there was a great bang, and you just said that you were airborne, and you had to start flying. I mean, it was from just sitting there to being airborne was a matter of a second and a half or something. Very short space of time.
What training had you received?
Well, all you had, the only training you had, was you did a short, very short refresher on hurricanes again. At Speak, up in near Liverpool. And then they had a launch thing on the ground, launch rocket rail on the ground. And Speak then had no runway; it was a grass field, it was quite a small field. And so whether it was in the wind or not, into the wind, they didn't worry too much. And that's when you had your first go. And I tell you, when they said, "Yeah," and the bang you could hear all over Liverpool. Bang! This a tremendous bang of these rockets going off, and you know, you've seen a couple of chaps go off, and you think, Christ, they got off and wobbled about a bit and get level. So then it's your turn to get in, and I can tell you, your heart doesn't half start to beat because you're trying to remember all you have to do. You sit there and you wait, you blow, and it's 3 seconds, bang! Suddenly you're airborne, quite close to the ground because it's underground, and you fly off and fly around. So that's the only thing, I think, had one or two, perhaps, of those, I'm not sure.
Was it with a hurricane?
A hurricane.
So you practiced with the hurricane?
Yes, we did, when Speak, then we had a few flights with the hurricane ones and old hurricanes that weren't needed to do any serious fighting.
So would you fly around and then do, with those hurricanes, the practice ones, would they have the capacity to land? Well, they'd have to, wouldn't they?
They all had the capacity to land. They're just ordinary hurricanes. All the same, exactly, nothing, no modifications to them, apart from the bolts that were either side where the cams went, that they where you put on the trolley, that released to let you fly off them.
Who would release those when they were? Would that be the mate's job to release the bolts?
No, that happened automatically, because when the trolley had got to the end of its run, it came up against two dampers and it stopped it. When it came to the damage, some cams went up, and the hurricane was pulling that way because the bolts were that way tight. They then opened. They were opened automatically by these cams hitting the end of the run on the rails. So they hadn't opened. It came to a grinding halt. So they opened, you hoped. But it was all, when I looked around, I thought, well, what if that doesn't work? You know, that's bloody Heath Robinson thing. That's not, the bolt's not tight. And
it seems quite a little bit of training, really, for quite
yes.
a difficult job, actually, because, you know, a couple of times at Speak doesn't seem very
much. We're all experienced fighter pilots, anyway. And we'd all had experience in combat, and, you know, we knocked about a bit. I think everybody's flown hurricanes. So it's just getting re-established on hurricanes again, and how they flew and all the rest of it. And then bang, you're off, and then you just have to wait for your first ship.
Would it have been, they could have only have used the Hurricane, as opposed to, say, a Spitfire in that situation? Because obviously, you've mentioned earlier in the recording how strong the Hurricane's construction was. Was it chosen for that, or was it the fact that these Hurricanes were at the end of their lives?
Well, I think it was the latter, really. I think they were always short of aircraft. They were always, you know, always trying to build more aircraft, and Spitfire was the aircraft that was being built, and the Hurricane was being phased out. And the ones we were given to emergency fighter unit had been dragged out of the channel and sort of hosed down and sort of fairly decrepit aircraft. Because they were just one-shot aircraft, you know. When the idea was that you're always on the wing of the convoy. I went to the convoy briefing, first of all. And this is my first trip across the Atlantic. I went to the convoy briefing. And there was two pilots. So you take it in turns. It was 2 hours on, 2 hours off. And the convoy commanders, normally their commodore, would get up and say what was going to happen, which way they were going to go, north of Iceland, south of Iceland, or whatever. And because we went to Halifax in Nova Scotia mainly. And then he'd say, and we have with us this on this trip, something you would have seen before. It's a hurricane on a mountain on a merchant ship, which is. The whole idea of this was that. Condors is the first big four-engine military aircraft that the Germans had built. They suddenly decided they were going to use those They knew if they could solve Britain, we'd be out of the war, or solve America, what we're getting here. So if they could really decimate the merchant fleet, then the war would be over. So the Germans used them for long-range flights over the Atlantic, spotting convoys, sending the information back to U-boats, who used to go and wait in packs in the direction which we were headed. That's why convoys zigzagged the whole time. You'd be on that course for a minute, then the whole 40 ships in the convoy would go on that course and zigzag. But it was always a general direction of where you're trying to get to, so the convoy could work this out. And they knew that if they kept away from the defences of the ships, that they were quite safe. They just radio back, they just circled the convoy for quite a while, and send all back their information. And like that, they were very, very good at that, and we lost a lot of merchant ships there. And I think it was Churchill who suddenly thought of the idea of, well, why can't we have some catapult fighters? So he thought, well, okay, well, just shoot these condors down. So that was our main job, was to shoot down condors from that circling the convoy. So we were always, so we could turn into wind if the wind were, say, we were always on the wing of the convoy. We were leading the columns on one wing, either the right wing or the left wing, so that if we had to fire off, the captain could turn his way from the convoy into wind, and we could then launch, and then theoretically go and shoot down the condor, and then come back and at the briefing before we went, the air commodore would designate. Normally you had a destroyer leading the escorting fleet of naval vessels, and then corvettes and frigates all round. And the idea was that you bailed out, you went a mile ahead of the destroyer, which was designated at the time during the briefing. Lieutenant Commander so-and-so, you're the man who will pick this chap up if he bails out. And the idea was to fly a mile in front of him, bail out into the sea, and then he would pick you up. But the problem with that grand theory was that naval vessels in combat are going at top speed the whole time, because a naval vessel standing to in water, it is sitting duck for a torpedo from a U-boat. And of course they want to get the naval vessels out of the way quickly, so they get the destroyers just standing idle in the water, plunk, sitting target. So they never did. They kept going around. I think they picked one or two up. But it was hairy. I mean, first of all, you're constantly, it was most uncomfortable. I mean, these merchant ships were terribly uncomfortable. Oh, two of us were squeezed into a little cabin, one of us slept on the floor, one was in a bunk, full of cockroaches. You couldn't take your clothes off ever throughout the whole trip. 6 weeks trip to, or 4 weeks, you know, 6-knot convoy sometimes. 6 knots. You stick your walking pace. You had to go, the convoy had to travel at the speed of the slowest vessel. So, dramatically slow. And then, of course, long circuitous routes around Iceland to try and miss the U-boat packs. Every so often the U-boats would be in the vicinity, and of course the destroyers would come and depth charge, and it's booms going on and bangs and and the discomfort. I mean, you're in clothes. On my first trip, I got scabies. I don't know what scabies are. It's just through dirty blankets and things, and little.
Like a mite.
Little mite that gets burrows under your skin. Lays its eggs, then lays some more, and it's all under your skin, but it itches like mad. And they go for the warm spots, armpits, around your crotch, underneath here. And this red rash, with thousands of these things under here, just grows and grows, and it's scratching all the time. Well, you can't take your clothes off. The captain wouldn't allow you. He said, no, he said, because if we get hit, you've got to get off. And so we always had a pack. We call it the standby pack, which you've just grabbed with a few necessities and wrapped for a lifeboat and got off you if you were hit. or went if you went over the side, you had this stuff with you. But I got it, and I said, look, Captain, I've got this bloody, I can't stand this, terrible issue. He said, oh, right. He said, I've got some sulfur ointment, that'll fix that, which wouldn't do any good at all, really. But anyway, he said, go to your cabin, take your clothes off very quickly, smear this on all the affected areas, and put your clothes back on immediately. Well, a sticky, gooey sulfur ointment I put all over me and all the places, and put my clothes back on. Now, you can imagine.